This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
In our most recent public memory, images of the Prophet Muhammad have caused a great deal of controversy, such as the satirical cartoons in French magazine Charlie Hebdo. The sometimes violent backlash to these images has reinforced a popular narrative that Islam is aniconic and iconoclastic. In The Praiseworthy One, The Prophet Muhammad in Islamic Texts and Images, published with Indiana University Press, Christiana Gruber demonstrates that there is a long, rich history of images of Muhammad from within the Islamic tradition. The styles, themes, and strategies used to represent the Prophet have significantly shifted and altered over time. Gruber synthesizes an extensive archive of images and leads the reader through various thematic patterns, cultural specificities, and unique examples. We are presented with a detailed overview of textual and visual representations of Muhammad that is placed within a deep understanding of the history of Islamic art. In our conversation, we discussed how the iconoclasm narrative has been reinforced, the symbolic prophet versus a historical Muhammad, why there exists no very early images, the first visual representations of Muhammad, the prophet as king and hero, representations of Muhammad's spiritual radiance, images in the context of fraternal Sufi communities, Safavid images in the centering of Shia interpretations of Muhammad, images of Ali, Ottoman visual culture embodying Muhammad through objects and relics, modern renderings of Muhammad, and public scholarship and the constraints of academic writing. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Christiana Gruber about The Praiseworthy One, The Prophet Muhammad in Islamic Texts and Images. Welcome, Christy. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about your very beautiful and very well-written book, The Praiseworthy One. It really, as somebody who's not in kind of Islamic art, it's a treat to get a book like this and spend so much time with it, because we often don't have these images. But before we get into the book, we always start conversations a little bit about how authors come to the study of Islam, in your case, Islamic art. What were particular moments or individuals that kind of helped you find your path in terms of your interest in Islamic studies?
Well, for me, it began when I was 16 years old. I was a junior in high school looking for summer possibilities, and I applied for a fellowship to go study in the Middle East that was offered by the American Council of U.S. Arab Relations. Luckily, I was one of 30 students who was selected to go abroad, and my group of 10 juniors was sent to Tunisia. So at 16, I spent the summer in Tunisia taking Arabic language classes, history of the Arab world, and we traveled all around the country. At that point, that was my only introduction and experience in the Middle East. I had spent my whole life up till that point in Europe. I also had lived in Australia and in Yugoslavia. But I hadn't, and I am from Switzerland, so I hadn't had any languages or experience within the Islamic world. But that formative experience really changed the course of my career. I then went back and finished my last year in high school. And once I got to Princeton, I knew I wanted to do art history. Started off in European art history, but then took Arabic and took more Islamic studies courses at Princeton. And by the time my senior year had rolled around, I decided to write a senior thesis on Mamluk metalware. Another really important moment for me was the summer of my junior year at Princeton when I interned in the Department of Islamic Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And that was really what convinced me to pursue a PhD. I worked with Stefano Carboni at the Met. I was lucky enough to rewrite some of the labels in the galleries and to work on a publication known as the Kutubi Aminbar publication. And so when I decided this was really what I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing, I couldn't have imagined a better mentor than Renata Hollett at the University of Pennsylvania. And the rest was history after that.
That's saying a lot, because you're a very accomplished scholar. You've really written a lot, and you do a lot of curation. You've also been a very influential mentor to many people who are now also emerging as important folks in Islamic art. Where does this book, The Praiseworthy One, fit in with all of these various things that you've done? Can you talk a little bit about how this particular book project started to emerge? How does it fit into these kind of this larger research trajectory that you've been on?
I would say that this was a long, winding road. And I think most of us have the same story. There's never a straight forward path to a particular project. And this was my third book. So it was really more than, I would say, a dozen years in the making. The seeds for this book come from my dissertation on texts and images of the Prophet Muhammad's ascension in the pre-modern period. And when I was writing that dissertation, I was really interested in the intersection between, I would say, prose renderings of the ascension and then how the ascension was conceptualized as at a visual level. And so when I was explaining the images, I actually saw that there was a development of iconography for the prophet within the Miraj or the ascension cycle, and I couldn't leave it unaddressed. That was just a tiny portion of the dissertation because that was not the main theme. And then I started to really think about the ways in which the prophet was described in texts and images, starting from the perspective of the celestial ascension. And I started accumulating more information and materials from collections worldwide. And the more I collected, the more I realized that there was a lack of information and a lack of scholarship on the topic. And there were quite a few misconceptions around it. And those misconceptions really flared up in 2005 with the Ullensposten cartoon controversy, when we first started hearing that quote-unquote Islam bans images, especially that of the prophet. And then that rhetoric became even more trenchant in the wake of the assassination of the cartoonists at the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris in 2015. And with each one of these events, I noticed that the historical materials of Islam were being refracted through the lens of these particularly gruesome events. So I felt the need to put the data out there to not have it imbricated in ideological wranglings, and in a way to allow it to speak as forcefully as it could for itself. So it's, I would say, a project that was born out of my intellectual interests in both Islamic studies and art history. When you put those fields together, I think some new findings can emerge, as it does a lot of interdisciplinary work. But then the I would say the earth sort of shifted below us, And that meant my research was on a wholly new foundation when it came to public perceptions of Islam. And I had to make the decision as to whether or not to leave that research of mine behind or to actually make it more accessible, to engage in a form of, I would say, cultural preservation and try to capture as best as I could the really textured history of Islam in its very many different manifestations over the centuries.
Yeah, and so this long history is interesting because of kind of the urgency that our times have kind of made your work. And you know, you kind of address this later on in the book, but I think it makes sense to kind of ask it now. Is this kind of popular notion that Islam is iconoclastic? Can you talk a little bit about where that narrative comes from? And then also you kind of allude to it, and I don't know the literature well, so how have scholars kind of tackled this claim before you? Because you seem like you are kind of trying to make an intervention here in the scholarly conversation about ideas about iconoclasm.
Oh, that's a great question, because from my point of view, the scholarship around image making in Islam over the past 100 years has been incredibly schizophrenic. On the one hand, you find scholars who want to emphasize what they see as the differential quality of Islamic traditions. And when they wish to explain how Islam is different from, say, Christianity, they'll latch on to the notion that there are no images of God, no images of the Prophet, that Islam at best shies away from images, that it's aniconic. And so they'll pick a corpus of materials, if that is their main thrust in their argument, that indeed are aniconic. So you'll look at the Dome of the Rock, you'll go inside the building, and a scholar will say, well, look, this is an heir to the Byzantine tradition. We have mosaics, but in this case, the mosaics are non-figural. We have vegetal motifs, we have inscriptions, and ergo, Islam as an abstract entity is anti-image. So for me, the problem with that is that it only captures one element of Islamic artistic expressions. And indeed, in many settings and contexts, there are no figural images. And that is something that one has to speak about. But it doesn't hold true in all settings and all times. And so in other scholarly, I would say, endeavors, you'll see entire books dedicated to the figural imagery of Islam, on Persian painting in particular. And there, the early scholars will speak about Persian painting as an expression of the genius of Islam, that it has a high point or zenith in the period of the Timurids, and they liken those productions to the Medici and so on. So it's very bifurcated. And my worry with both of those approaches is that we have a tendency sometimes to latch onto an argument and then we cherry pick our data to support that, what you would call an inductive rather than a deductive approach. And so one has to find a middle path in speaking about the artistic traditions of individuals who happen to practice in Muslim majority lands. And those practices are complex. They vary from time to time. In one place at one time, you might see an iconoclastic act, say, the dynamiting of the Bamiyan Buddhas. But that event is deeply imbricated in a whole host of other factors that have to do with politics, that have to do with sanctions, that have to do with minority communities. And so we have to look at all those different elements in the puzzle and not just see the image as qua image, as the problem in and of itself. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously the book, I think, really challenges that narrative very, very clearly. One of the other contexts that, I mean, there's tons of literature on Muhammad, and a lot of it tries to get at what we might think of as a historical Muhammad. And your book is definitely not trying to do that. And I think you use the language of metaphor or a symbolic lexicon. So can you talk about how the sources that you're looking at, how do they use Muhammad as a symbol, and how might these kind of imagined ways of thinking about the prophet differ from the type of approach that someone seeking a historical Muhammad might take?
That's a really good question. Yeah, when I was starting off with this, you know, many individuals asked me, well, you know, who was Muhammad and what did he look like?
Yeah.
And the answer is always, well, I don't know. You know, we have this and that from the text, and there are, of course, many scholars out there who've been very interested in reconstructing the historical Muhammad based on evidence that can be gleaned from, say, most recently, one call from the Quran or from the Hadith, right, which are considered the verbal relics of the Prophet. We can glean plenty of biographical information about him from the Sirah genre, right, from the biographical text, but even those were written after his lifetime. And what was striking to me is even in one's own lifetime, myths emerge about certain personalities. So Christian, for example, you might have some myths that are wild around you that you might not be aware of that are propagated among groups of people. Myths emerged about the Prophet Muhammad already in his lifetime. So you can be mythologized in the living. And so the more you extract an individual from his or her time, the more that personality can be put through procedures of imagination that can be creative and can be reformulated through the lens of the present. And to my mind, a much more fruitful exercise when it comes to understanding the creative imaginations that are riveted around the Prophet would be to understand the Prophet not only as a historical person that indeed lived in the full light of history, but actually as a larger metaphor and embodiment for the community of the faithful. So an early, for example, exegete might understand the Prophet much more in a different way than, say, a medieval Sufi, than, say, a member of a militant group today. You have progressive Muslims, you have Salafi Muslims, you have American Muslims and Chinese Muslims, and every community and every individual will look to the Prophet to find a beautiful exemplar to understand how one should live one's best life. And so that can take on all sorts of different iterations, and those iterations get even more multiplied once the imagination is a pictorial one.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Much of the book then, it's kind of combination of chronological order, but also then kind of thematic. And in the very early periods, we don't have any existing images from the very early centuries. So I'm wondering if you could talk about why we don't have any, but also how we know they existed and what they might have been used for during this period.
That's a great question. Yeah, the earliest images of the Prophet that survive today date from the 1200s. And so there is this really substantial gap between the moment of the Prophet's life in the 7th century and the earliest extant images that are from the 1200s. We're talking about more than 5 centuries. This is a big lacuna, and it is openly talked about in the field of Islamic history, because this is probably the most major gap in terms of artistic production. We do have plenty of buildings, archaeological sites, metalware, ceramics from those centuries, but not really painting. One possibility, and this is the one that is that you hear about most often is that it's possible that images of the Prophet had been made, did exist from those centuries between the 700s and the 1200s, but it's possible that they were destroyed when the famous House of Wisdom, a library in Baghdad, was destroyed under the Mongols in 1258. 1258 being a major marking point here. That is a possibility, considering that the real uptick in the corpus of extant images of the Prophet dates from the early 1300s. So that's one possibility, and it's I wouldn't say extremely likely, but it's a possibility. The other is that there might not have been much of a tradition of representing of the Prophet during those first five centuries, and that in reality, the genesis or the beginning of religious imageries dedicated to Muhammad is in fact attributable to the reign of the Ilkhanids, these Mongol rulers of Iran that brought with them traditions of figural imagery from Buddhist traditions of Central Asia in particular. So I would say that it's potentially a combination of both factors.
You also talk about, I think you call them textual images, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of these narratives where we hear about images, and what do they say?
I call those picturations, in fact, or textual pictures. And there are a number of textual narratives that, in fact, talked about images of Muhammad. And the most common of those narratives is known as the narrative of Heraclius, the Byzantine emperor. And there are variants of this narrative, but the basic gist is that the Byzantine emperor Heraclius had a chest of sorts with drawers in it, and therein he preserved figural portraits of the great prophets, of the Abrahamic traditions in particular. And the prophet's emissaries went to Heraclius, and when he opened the drawer, we're told he saw an image, and Muhammad's companions did as well. We're not told what the image looked like, although there are insinuations that it was radiant, that it exuded light, whereupon the companions of the prophet who had been sent to the court of Heraclius burst into tears, recognizing Muhammad. And then usually the tale ends with Heraclius more or less converting to Islam. So this is one of the very interesting topoi, what you would call a conversion narrative. And there are different kinds of conversion narratives out there in the Islamic tradition, both conversion initiation and foretelling narratives. This one, in a way, predicts the fall of Constantinople and the rise of Muslim power around the Mediterranean. And the conversion itself occurs thanks to a figural image of the Prophet Muhammad. So it's a very powerful tale that not only does not shy away or prohibit figural imagery, but actually sees figural imagery as a potential catalyst for luring, converting, drawing individuals of other faiths to the cause of Islam.
Now, when we do start to have a kind of archive of images, what are those earliest visual representations of Muhammad look like? And what do they tell us about this cultural context in which they emerge?
So the earliest images of the Prophet Muhammad tend to represent him as a king who is sitting on a throne. And this was something that dawned on me only years into the making of this project. It was a struggle, as you mentioned, to find the right structure, because I didn't want the book to be solely chronological. I wanted to understand major moments or pivots or clusters of images. And it just so happened that this earliest imagery represents Muhammad as an enthroned king. And so I had to ask myself, well, why in these earliest images does Muhammad look so much like a regal figure who's holding audience in a court-like setting. And so there I played around with notions of kingship, of welcome, of having a court of sorts. Who is at that court? Is the prophet seated alone, or is potentially Ali sitting next to him, or is the Ahlul Bayt also contained on the throne? And what does that mean in terms of imagining a prophet king with his larger family or offspring? And can we then start to even see the seeds of sectarian differentiation? And if not, then is it a more inclusive view of what prophethood might look like if we're not to draw sectarian lines too strictly in the early period? The other thing I noticed with these earliest images of Muhammad enthroned is that he is fully represented in terms of his physical attributes and his facial features. So he is a human being fully in the flesh. You can see his eyes, his nose. You can see his prophetic tresses, right? His hair. He typically wears a turban, and he does not have an aureole. He does not exude light. But there are some manipulations in those images that make it clear that this is not just an earthly king. This is an earthly king with prophetic attributes. And so typically in those images, you'll see Muhammad enthroned, surmounted by flying angels that hold a canopy-like ribbon above him. Sometimes they can be holding light rays above him, or they might be holding a vessel, pouring maybe a sacred substance or a kind of aromatic essence upon him. So these angelic beings show to us that this is a prophet who has been selected by God through these angelic proxies, that he's been given the light of God, that he has a prophetic scent from paradise, but none of those more metaphorical or allegorical elements are actually embedded in his physical self and exuding from there. So they're what I call external signs of his prophecy that are added to an otherwise earthly kingly scene of enthronement. So I refer to those scenes as Muhammad the prophet king. And beyond that, from a political point of view, I think it's important to think through those images, because those images craft a notion not just of prophecy for Muhammad, but royalty for those monarchs who are actually commissioning these images. So in a sense, Muhammad indeed is envisioned as a king, but a ruling monarch could be envisioned as a prophet as well. So I think the engagement is bilateral. And the strength of rulership can also be carried over to a ruling monarch who himself is seen as the shadow of God on earth.
Now, the next kind of the theme or pattern or cluster you look at is a kind of heroic prophet. So when and where did this motif start to emerge? What strategies were deployed to mark Muhammad as a hero?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there I was very inspired by Campbell's work on the hero, because in many world traditions, the various motifs that accompany notions of our herohood are pretty similar. And in the case of Muhammad, some of those same topoi can be found as well. So a hero is born at a felicitous conjunction in time. A hero has the markings of herohood already at the very beginning of his or her career. A hero has to go through trials and tribulations, and not only does he have to survive them, he has to come out of those trials stronger and more agile. A hero has to be recognized as a hero after he's initiated into herohood in some fashion. And a hero has to be capable of supernatural feats. In the case of Muhammad, ascending to the heaven or splitting the moon or surviving the cracking open of his chest. And then the hero has to make an exit in some fashion. So all of those tropes I found in the biographical tales of the prophet, and they're also in the corpus of images as well. So if we are to start from the very beginning of his life, of course, when he's born, then the marks of herohood are already there in the tales and in the images, whereby we're told that when his mother was pregnant, that she exuded a light from her belly, that when Muhammad was born, she received a revelation that he had to be called Muhammad, which is a praise name, the praised one or the praiseworthy one. So even our hero has a praise name. When he's born, all sorts of interesting things are said to happen. A light is exuding from his body. The idols at the Kaaba come collapsing and break to smithereens. In other tales, especially from Iranian lands, we're told that the arch of Khusra in Ctesiphon comes crumbling down. So these are sort of end of old world order symbols that are smitten in the wake of the coming into the world of this hero. So that is one sort of heroic bursting into being that you see applied to the prophet. And another sort of major heroic motif for Muhammad is his celestial ascension as well, where he's able to rise through the skies in the span of one night. He gets to meet the angels, the prophets. He has an intimate colloquy with God without any intermediaries. He gets to visit heaven and hell so that he could tell his community upon his return of the rewards that await the faithful, and of course the various punishments for those who are either not of the faith or who commit a range of sins as well. So I found those particular topoi particularly interesting, and as it turns out, those are the ones that are most often put to picture as well from the 1300s onward.
Now, you kind of lead into this idea of Muhammad as a light, and you explore this more in the next chapter, which you focus on what you call mystical visions of the prophet. So this idea of the light of Muhammad, how does this get, or what is this, and then how does this get visualized? What kind of iconographical devices were used to represent this idea of Muhammad's radiance?
Yeah, so the light of Muhammad, otherwise known as Nur Muhammad or Nur-e Muhammad in a more Persian genitive construct, the light of Muhammad is a very old concept, I would say, and you can find it across different fields of Islamic literature. If you go all the way back to the Quran, there are a number of verses that speak about light, about nur, the most famous being Ayat al-Nur, or the verse of light. This is the most important of the verses that touch upon the notion of a light glowing in a lamp, neither of the east nor the west. We also talk here in the Quran of God sending a book and a light to his people to lead them out of darkness. Exegetes, so interpreters of the Quran, especially those of a spiritualist or Sufi leaning, tended to interpret the word nur or light as the Prophet Muhammad. So if you were to read the verse, God sends a book and light to his to the faithful, the book is the Quran and the light is Muhammad. So Muhammad oftentimes, and not just in Sufi cultures, was thought of as embodied light, as an entity that was sent by God to mankind to impart enlightenment, to give lessons of the faith, to lead them out of darkness, to lead them to salvation, to intercede on their behalf. And so that is a motif that is prevalent across all these texts. There's an uptick in the Light of Muhammad motif, especially in the medieval period, the 11th century onward for Islam. And it's a key motif in Sufi literature in particular, where Sufis might be able to contemplate the light of Muhammad internally or spiritually in some way. Now, the paintings that really engage with the light of Muhammad, as it so happens, are medieval and post-medieval, and they can be tethered to a more Sufi environment, especially Herat in modern-day Afghanistan during the last quarter of the 15th century, the Timurid period. This is the period of Jami, for example. So those paintings engage with the topic of the Nur Muhammad by representing the prophet as a blaze of light. So either Muhammad is fully represented in the flesh with facial features, but is crowned by a flaming halo or aureole, or that flaming aureole can in fact take over his facial features, which you can see, in fact, in the image on the cover of the book, where even Muhammad's veil looks as if it's aflame. And so the heart, if you like, of this blazing, exuberant light is actually thought to be incubating, so to speak, from the head of the prophet in the medieval period. In later centuries, especially in the area of Kashmir today, 18th and 19th centuries, Muhammad is represented only as a bundle of light. And so the aureole will subsume his entire physical casing of sorts. And that's really the last step in the process of metaphorically imagining Muhammad not just as a human being, but as light incarnate.
Now, other images were important within a Sufi context, and you bring some examples about their use in kind of brotherhood communities. So what were the purposes of these images within in that context of kind of master-disciple spiritual teaching?
Yeah, these images that I mentioned, which emerge especially during the last quarter of the 15th century in Herat, tend to be part of fraternal milieus, especially of the Naqshbandi order. I find it interesting that even the term Naqshband means to bind yourself to a Naqsh, to an image. So, you know, in a way, the Naqshbandiya is really a binding of the image fraternity, etymologically speaking. So the Naqshbandiya, this Sufi brotherhood, this tariqa, is known to have engaged in a number of different practices through which a pupil could become much more closely connected to his master. So the master-pupil or the peer-murid connection had to be extremely strong. And the master could be not just his immediate master, but master going through the lineage or the line of masters going back to the Ur master or the first master. And that was always imagined as the Prophet Muhammad. So in the Naqshbandiya, in that brotherhood, there are two practices that really caught my eye. One was the notion of rabita, which is establishing a connection, a linking or a chaining. And it's very clear that there were multiple ways of creating a connection or a binding, if you like, to a master. One was to imagine that individual in your mind's eye, to maybe have dreams of that master. Oftentimes masters, including the Prophet Muhammad, are said to come to pupils in their dreams and to reveal certain things about the realm of the mysterious, the realm of the unseen. So I see those images from within those Sufistic milieus as establishing a rabita, an actual bilateral exchange between the viewer, who's a murid in a way, and the representation of the peer, which is Muhammad and his entourage potentially. So rabita is one of those practices of chaining or linking or bilateral exchange. The other that is very prevalent also in the Naqshbandiya is the notion of tawajjuh, which means facing, going face to face. In those particular Sufi milieus, it's believed that if you cogitate strongly enough upon your master, if you have a dream, then you can come face to face with that individual through sustained spiritual contemplation, which can include practices of dhikr, right, of remembrance, collective remembrance, remembrance that is in a group that can be allowed or can be uttered in a very isolated chamber known as a khalwa. You know, you can be all by yourself in a small chamber in isolation and you can come face to face with your master, or you can be in the collective remembrance a scenario and you can engage in a collective dhikr, and then a master can come to that community. So these images could have been viewed as a way of coming face to face with the Prophet, a literal face to face. They could be used by an individual person in a private environment, or they could, these images in manuscripts could have been used in more social arenas, such as a majlis or a coming together for the purposes of reading, the purposes of recollection. And so I tend to also think about these illustrated books wherein these paintings do survive as potentially going from hand to hand in a majlis setting, so in a group setting. And the fact that oftentimes in these paintings, Muhammad is shown as the ultimate master in a majlis setting, in a seated scenario, may reflect the actual practices of establishing rabita and tawajjuh with the Prophet at this time.
Now, one big shift in some of the imagery that you point to is under the Safavids. So can you talk a little bit about how visual culture operated under the Safavids, what kind of images we find, and what their function was in this context?
Yeah, the Safavids were extraordinary patrons of illustrated manuscripts, and there are many images of the Prophet Muhammad within the illustrated manuscripts of the Safavid tradition, in particular over the course of the 1500s. And what was really striking to me when I started looking at that material is that really the earliest surviving evidence for the use of the facial veil really must be attributed to the Safavids, to the early 1500s. So it seems that the facial veil is an invention of Shah Ismail I, so the first ruler of the Safavids. And it's not the only thing that happens. At the same time, Muhammad tends to be outfitted with a special turban that has a tall rod. And that turban is known as the Taj-e Haidari, or Haidar's crown. And it's essentially Shi headgear. The rod represents the imams. So at the same time as the facial veil emerges, we see sort of Shiified headgear applied to the Prophet. And then on top of that, oftentimes we also see the facial veil also applied to Ali, and at times also the imams. So for me, the question then became, rather than say the facial veil was articulated as a way to camouflage Muhammad's facial features in order to avoid a veristic representation or the representation of his facial features, the question, the more pressing question for me became, well what are the other reasons that the facial veil would emerge under the early Safavid in the tandem of the Taj-e Haidari and the facial veil also applied to Ali? And so if you look carefully at Shi'i texts in particular, there are all sorts of hints and insinuations that the facial veil is about hiding in plain sight, the notion of taqiyya. If you hide the facial features of Muhammad, he becomes an increased mystery. He's too brilliant to behold. At the same time, you're not quite sure who that individual is behind the facial veil. And if that individual is wearing the Taj-e Haideri, could that individual be also Shah Ismail? Mm-hmm. And we do know that Shahs, the Safavid Shahs among them, liked to play with this double entendre, the prophet-like kings or kings that come close to being, let's say, the new Ali or the new sort of manifestation, the new theosis, right, of God on earth. And so the facial veil makes you question whether you're looking at Muhammad or you're looking at a Safavid monarch. And if the facial veil is also applied to Ali, then that suggests that Ali partakes in the same veiled mystery and therefore prophetic rank as the Prophet Muhammad himself. So it allows for an elevation of Ali himself, which is an effort that is sustained in Shi textual production, and there's certainly a flourishing of that in the Safavid period as well.
Now, this is kind of connected in a contradistinction between the Ottoman context, where we have kind of also new developments in kind of the representation of Muhammad. So can you talk a little bit about what's happening in the Ottoman visual culture? How were kind of multi-sensory images or objects used in that context?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the Ottoman context, especially I would say after the 17th century, which did the late 16th century witnessed also pictorial imagery within illustrated manuscripts, the Sira Nebi or the Life of the Prophet being the chief example of pictorial images within a manuscript context. But what is most striking in the Ottoman context, especially from the 1700s onward, is a shying away from illustrated manuscripts and figural paintings to a whole new innovative way of thinking about Muhammad through synecdoche, through pars pro toto, through allegory. So, for example, oftentimes you see the production of prayer books known as dua names, and in those prayer books, you'll see representations of Muhammad's relics. So the Ottomans were very interested in representing Muhammad's robe, his hair strand, his prayer rug, his sandals. They were also very interested in collecting those objects per se. And the Topkapı Palace remains today the major repository of the relics of the Prophet Muhammad. If you go to Topkapı, you'll find his footprints on stone that are attributed to the Prophet Muhammad. You'll find his mantle, his robe, and you'll find hair strands within transparent containers. So in the Ottoman period, there's an urge to collect these, by far and large, contact relics. These are secondary relics of the Prophet Muhammad, save for, say, the strands of his beard, which are the protein exuviae, right, of the Prophet Muhammad's body. So they're not like body part relics like you find in Christian traditions. So these are objects that are touched by the barakah, by the blessing of Muhammad, and they become central to some of the religious practices of the Ottoman royal household. So for example, the Ottomans were in the practice of touching and kissing Muhammad's footprints. From time to time, those footprints, just like the mantle, would be washed. The water runoff would be collected and kept in little vials to be then mixed into other flasks or other liquids to create an elixir or a curative potion of sorts. This is what you would call tibba nebi, or the medicine of the prophet. At other times, these little vials would be used to break the fast during the month of Ramadan. So what I find interesting in those practices is that it's no longer about contemplating an image. It's about materially and physically interacting with objects, material objects, through rubbing, through kissing, and not just gazing. And oftentimes that involves also the practice of ingestion, ingestion especially of water that has touched the prophetic barakah. So that made me think of, well, how can you come into contact with the Prophet Muhammad? One way to do that is to activate your inner Muhammad, to become almost epigenetically prophet-like through practices of imbibing and ingestion as well.
Now, you take us all the way to the modern period in the book, and you know, some of the stuff that's happening in the recent past is really interesting, because it is both kind of innovating, but also then kind of taking, you know, new takes on these older traditions. So can you talk a little bit about how do images of the Prophet operate today? Where do we find them? What do people do with them? Yeah,
that last chapter is the messiest chapter of the book. As you will have noticed, you know, all the other chapters feel much more cohesive because the clusters are pretty coherent in and of themselves. And I really struggled with that last chapter because I wanted the last chapter to be coherent. And then I realized I was trying to force the material into a coherence that in fact was not there. And so what I'm trying to do with that last chapter is to capture the messiness of the modern period, because there is no one tale to tell. You know, some traditions reiterate and reassert the pictorial images of the Ilkhanid period. Others prefer to turn to the Ottoman tradition. Others are inspired by calligraphic traditions, whereby Muhammad is a calligram. Others prefer to look at Muhammad as a synecdoche, taking his sample print as a key stand him or a logo, if you like. And so these modern experiments in representing the Prophet are nothing if not a mixed bag. And that has been the case at least up until, I would say, the end of the 20th century. And after that, the picture tends to change pretty dramatically in the wake of our cartoon controversies, because those two events of 2005 and 2015, a decade apart, have really altered the course of the practice of imagining the Prophet, because perforce now we have trouble looking at those traditions without, in a way, these modern debacles coloring our perception. And so now there's great hesitation to make images of the Prophet Muhammad, precisely because of the rather trenchant narratives that have emerged over the course of the past 15 years. So I would say that's a damage that has been done, but it's also part of the larger tale. And I think it says a lot to us about what are some of the very current circumstances that can lead to innovations that we might not be aware of, also that stretch back in the centuries, 1501 being a major marking point there, for the rise of the Safavids marked a huge switch in the tradition of representing the Prophet. The veil came, that was more or less invented then and became a staple. So perhaps then we have a new staple in another world event right now, with the net result being an increasing shying away from representational images of the Prophet Muhammad. So the tale is not over. We are just in a moment, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens next.
Yes. Speaking of which, it would be great to hear what you're working on next. Could you tell us a little bit about projects you have underway, things you hope to do in the near future?
Yeah, I would say that right now, very presently, as we record this lovely interview, we are in the throes of a pandemic. So I've gone from a scholar to a chair of a department to, you know, managing a very large crisis in our academic worlds. So I'm learning a lot in the process. And what's been interesting for me is to really think about also artistically and creatively how individuals from Muslim majority lands have coped with moments of crisis, especially epidemics, historically. And so one piece I've just written, which is short, is entitled The Arts of Healing and Protection in Islam, Historical Objects in a Pandemic Moment, where I really think through the different tools and technologies and creative responses that Muslims have had when faced with disaster and disease. And so there I'm very interested in amulets and especially anti-plague amulets, amuletic designs, magical medicinal bowls, and talismanic shirts. And it's possible that this will turn into a bigger project. I'm mulling the idea of maybe launching a pandemic arts series of public essays and maybe roping in my colleagues from multiple fields across the world. So this is something that's unfolding right now, which, you know, might seem dated whenever this interview is available. But longer term, I have two book projects that are unfolding right now. One is on image fiascos, which is about fighting ideologically through images and determining the place of Islam in global visual cultures. And I have a number of case studies for that. This is a more of a modern project. And the second book project is entitled The Matter of Islam, Art, Vibrancy, and Religion. And it's more or less an eco-critical art history take on all sorts of artistic objects, architectures, and traditions that are riveted to the natural world within Islamic traditions. So these are two longer-term book-sized projects of mine. A couple chapters are, you know, sketched out, and there's some writing here and there, but I will have to put that, you know, sort of on low boil since I'm chair for 3 years. So it won't be for now, but I found that with The Praiseworthy One, incubating a book for a decade is a pleasure in and of itself. When the book comes out, that's certainly a joy, but the project is then behind you. And so I think, and this is really for all the academics out there, the real treasure of tenure in a way is the affordances that it allows you to concentrate very, very deeply, to dig, take the time to really mull through the sources, to synthesize them well, to test structures for books, let them go if they don't work. I threw away an entire chapter of this book that wasn't working. The Mughal chapter was just not working. There was not a cluster there. And no matter how much I wrestled with it, it just didn't pan out. So I think that hopefully in the future years, we'll feel less pressed and rushed to publish or perish, because in the end, the product has to be there to stay. And what really inspires me in my scholarship is a very short piece that Carl Ernst published in the International Journal of Middle East Studies some years ago, where he's asking us, nay, begging us to forego jargon, to think about dropping diacritics, to not hide behind too much theory. In other words, to engage in what he calls stealth analysis. And so what is my guiding ethos now is that I want extremely deeply rooted, well-macerated scholarship where I've had the time to think through a wide variety of materials and sources, to test structures, to fail at them, to throw them out the window, and to get a writing that is sturdy and that may seem simplistically clear, but is hopefully much more complex than what the eyes might see at first glance. And that in itself is an incredible challenge, I found, because it's meant undoing years of training at the graduate level, where you might think that the more jargon and the more theory you deploy, the more intelligent you seem. But once you take away that cladding, you have to be able to stand behind the evidence, its presentation, and your argument for decades to come. And that means putting yourself out there and being willing to stand by an argument, in a way, unclad by these fineries.
the unlearning of the academy.
Mm-hmm. It's been very difficult. But you know, those op-ed pieces I wrote in Newsweek, which went through many, many different cycles of editing with journalists, taught me a lot about how you should try to write for public audiences while still being beholden to the standards of the academy. And I think it's going to be important for all of us, including Islamicists, to wrangle with that. You know, what is the meaning? What are our duties as Islamic historians and experts of Islamic studies to not only do our work, but to make that work available and understandable to those who would be interested? I think that's that is definitely a duty for some, maybe not for others, but it's certainly a challenge that we need to be thinking about as a collective.
Well, thank you for doing the work, and thank you for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you so much for reading it. It's been a real pleasure. When you write, you know, books, it's a very lonely affair, and it's always surprising to me once a book is out that somebody is reading it. So thank you.
Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. That was my conversation with Christiana Gruber about The Praiseworthy One, The Prophet Muhammad in Islamic Texts and Images, published with Indiana University Press in 2019.